This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us for our Radio Main Street across North Dakota. And today we're going to begin our broadcast by talking to one of the candidates for Congress from North Dakota. Of course, the election is less than 3 months away. And Stephen James Peterson is the Libertarian candidate for U.S. House of Representatives from North Dakota. Stephen, thanks for joining us today.
The other way around, sir. Thank you very much for including me in this. We normally get ignored, and I am very appreciative of your time today.
Well, for our listeners who may not be acquainted with you, and of course, if you're going to be running for a statewide race, they need to know who you are. Give us a brief biography.
I don't know if I could do truly a brief biography. I'll hit some high points for you. I was born as an orphan here in the state of North Dakota and then adopted. Grew up in Fargo, North Dakota, son of a professor over at NDSU. He was a physics professor and attended Fargo Elementary, Junior High, and High School, and moved out to Montana when I graduated from high school for a winter, and then came back to North Dakota shortly thereafter and became a professional bounty hunter and bail agent for a period of 20 years. So I was hunting armed felons across the United States, and then after that for a period of time, I did open my own bail agency. I did have a detective agency for a period of time, and we also did a lot of legal process service across Colorado and Wyoming.
And now you have a company called Raven Rising?
Correct.
And what does that do?
Currently, we have two active arms to that company, and we're on the build with a third. But the first arm of our company, we're doing STEM education curriculum development with a team in Bismarck currently. I met that crew when I was working with the ARC of North Dakota about a year ago. And so I've onboarded them to create said curriculum. And Garmin is helping with our program development there. And it was really nice to have them come on board as a multinational company to help us create this curriculum for kids that are locked at home during this pandemic. And then the other arm of the company is more of a mechanical engineering arm, but we create zip lines, canopy tours, and challenge courses like those that you would find at Boy Scout camps, Bible camps, or on military training bases.
That's some significant variety. Why did you decide to run for Congress?
You know, I waited till the last second. I really did wait till the 11th hour to file for this. I wanted to make sure that my intentions were correct and pure before I took on this mantle of responsibility. And what moved me, What caused my spirit to stir so much to open myself up to the public ballot to address certain things that I don't believe are being handled properly or correctly by the current Congress and administration. And I think that we could do a better job. And I think that we could also do a much better job for all the citizens here in the state of North Dakota instead of focusing purely, and this is a libertarian about to say this, sir, that instead of being so focused solely on servicing and catering to corporations that are taking natural resources out of our state, that we need to reallocate our attention, especially during this time of the pandemic, to the people on the ground, because there's a lot of people that are getting missed right now here in the North Dakota area. Our safety net is failing them. They're slipping through. And, I'm reticent to berate the state for this. I realize everybody was caught with their pants down. I give it that. However, it's the mood and the attitude in certain instances that bother me. But yes, sir, on the federal side, I see certain laws that need to change expressly and pointedly on the cannabis platform, and also for the removal of the United States from the Single Convention Treaty.
But you are a libertarian, and yet what you were just talking about seems to be a bit at odds with the libertarian ideology, that is, that the individual, without restraint of government, typically forges his own path. Why did you decide to run as a libertarian?
Well, pointedly, the Republicans, according to their bylaws, won't accept me. Second part of that, where I see where you see the juxtaposition there and why there's some confusion, but you're forgetting one of the main tenets of libertarianism, and that is do no harm. So if we've gotten to a point in our society where we allow the creation of wealth for others, vacant ethics, morals, and well-being towards each other, then, sir, I'm sorry, that's not libertarian. A libertarian corporatist would make sure that their employees are fed and that their employees are clothed and that their employees are taken care of. We have examples of that today here in the United States, where we have CEOs that have abdicated taking any draws from their company, and they're putting that all back down into their employees so that they know that that housewife that works for them has two kids and her husband's doing night jobs and they were barely making ends before, that those people are not being left on the street. So I get where you see the confusion from what everybody concerns themselves about with libertarianism, but you're all forgetting about the humanitarian aspect of libertarianism. Do no harm is a primary tenet. And even corporations, even the financial invisible hand of Smith, does have to reconcile itself with its behavior and treatment towards humans. Not corporations are no more allowed to violate human rights than are any governments. Human rights are sacrosanct. They are important to all people. Yes, they came from religious history. However, we should recognize that humanity, the laws that we have created, the human rights that we have here in this country, the Bill of Rights specifically, are guaranteed to all people, regardless of race, creed, religion, sexual preference, or color.
It costs money to run a campaign, and we're about to get into that very intense season where we'll be seeing and hearing and reading positions from all kinds of candidates, and certainly the people you're running against for Congress from North Dakota. Why do you think libertarians don't get as much attention as the other candidates? Is it a money thing? Is it being able to afford to get your name out there?
I would say that that's very succinct and congruent with my campaign. There's a certain aspect of principles that the majority of the libertarians that I know carry. And in one of those principles is that right now, as I alluded to earlier, people are suffering due to the COVID-19 pandemic. I know people that are barely being able to pay their bills. Some of them are trying to figure out what to float from month to month, week to week right now, just to keep their kids at a modicum of food in the house. They're scared crapless right now that they'll get evicted or that they'll be foreclosed on. No, sir, this is not the campaign to be asking the common people and the other people and everyone else for money, because I do believe that our attention should be on helping them first. And I know that that goes against the put the mask on in the airplane first mentality that most Machiavellian candidates have. I, sir, do not have that. I believe that we need to focus on the people of North Dakota first. Again, libertarianism is about humanitarianism.
In a podcast I saw on your Facebook page, you raised the issue of pay to play. You accused some major media outlets in the state of requiring money for coverage. I assume that was advertising money, but there wasn't a clarification there. Is that the kind of barrier you face?
I'd argue that that is a very valid point here, that there are media outlets here in our region that if you're not spending X amount of campaign dollars with them, that you will never be able to get on to certain shows. That's why I was very glad that PBS called, and I'm very appreciative of you being here with me today, because I don't want to do the pay-to-play game, because in today's age, whoever leverages the most amount of marketing money can convince us of almost anything, and we need to be aware of that manipulation. The only way that I can guarantee to people in the state of North Dakota that my campaign is not manipulated by myself or others is to run it this time with no donations.
What would be your policy toward the pandemic? You've touched on this. I'm curious about how you would want to wrestle with policy to best help the people who are suffering through this experience.
Well, I appreciate that question. If you could repeat that in a little bit more of a niche, because there's so much going on there that there's no true, by and large, answers that I can give to the pandemic, because right now, you and I are discussing city policy, state policy, and federal policy, and international policy at once. So, hey, forgive me, but if you could clarify that question, please.
I would approach this as federal policy. If you were a member of Congress, what would you like to see Congress do to help cope with the pandemic?
You know, first, what we need to do is put partisanship aside and just get down to base facts. The division in Washington absolutely is abhorrent to me, especially when people are suffering. We need to come to a consensus. We need to speak plainly with the people of this country, as I do with you now, as you do with me now, and make sure that everybody understands that there's a lot of suck coming down the tunnel at us, but if we stick together and if we can just agree long enough to work together to one unified goal, that we could move much faster, much further, and have less deaths at this time. That's how I feel about federal policy in the moment. I also think that it's very disingenuous that many not needing companies decided to raid the EIDL loans and the PPP loans and to misrepresent themselves and to use that towards pecuniary gain instead of helping of people. That on the federal front is also rather abhorrent. The SBA is trying to catch up to that, but there was so little foresight with what we did in the CARES Act that we have created our own monster. So the handling of the pandemic, I think that on the White House, it's been, again, rather disturbing, especially when our Surgeon General comes on to CNN, Fox, and other major media outlets and praying, just short of crying, saying, people, please do not wear masks. When instead of giving that message and confusing the public, what he should have said is, we are experiencing a shortage of N95 masks made by 3M in the United States, and our healthcare workers cannot get enough of them. So that miscommunication could have been spoken plainly to the American people, and we would not be as in-depth into this pandemic as we are now. I guess I'm tired of federal influence from all directions, treating us, the voters, the citizens of this country, as children that need to be spoken down to in a demeaning fashion. I do believe I understand enough about economics and other aspects of government policy that we can speak plainly with each other. But instead, we have this paternal Washington that wants to nanny state us. And sadly, most recently, we're discovering that the Republicans are as bad at that as the Democrats are. So, yes, I see failure all around, but I will qualify that with the fact that this pandemic was not expected. It arose. It was spread. We could argue whether there was intent behind that or not, but the damage has been done regardless. We need to focus on helping people now. And the rhetoric that comes out of Washington that is only steeping the flames of war, we need to be very cautious and careful there. Our activity in the South China Sea at this time is concerning to me. Our activity with certain liaison groups in the Himalaya right now that have conflicted with the Chinese government troops, those are very disturbing to me. The writing is clearly on the wall that this administration has no problem starting a war with China, and we need to stop that immediately, unless there are no other options of diplomacy left.
Stephen Peterson is a Libertarian candidate for U.S. House for North Dakota. Stephen, the incumbent, Kelly Armstrong, garnered 97,000 votes in the June primary. If you were to debate him, where do you think his weaknesses would lie as a candidate?
You know, I with all due respect, sir, and kindness, I kind of don't like the characterization of that question. I am actually a huge fan of Mr. Armstrong. I may chastise him in my social media, but I'm not here to take the knees out of Kelly. If the North Dakota citizens decide that Mr. Armstrong is the best choice, then North Dakota should decide with him. I am not coming here to degrade the man. He's friends of mine, and I know his personal character and record is solid enough to where I can say I respect him. So, no, sir, I will not follow you down that road.
You had a long post on your Facebook page about the controversy concerning the Republican platform statements about LGBTQ. Would you let our listeners in on your point of view about that?
You don't have enough time for me to touch all the points about that, sir. And I say that with all due regard and respect. To say that the LGBTQ community is a complicated community with a lot of concerns that we need to address is a woeful understatement. The dictation of one's sexual preference or choice of partners upon oneself destroys all aspects of true human individuality. I believe that there are many people across this land that belong to Lutheran churches that have now women preachers and pastors that we have hopefully evolved in our society to recognize that some of these things that we do to each other are only barbaric vestiges of worst times of American and world history. No, I have many problems with the Republicans being anti-gay and anti-lesbian and anti-transgender and anti-anything else, because that was not the party that I was raised to understand. When Doris Bromenschenkel explained the Republican Party to me years ago, and many other influential Republicans of their time, that no, sir, it was not explained to me as a child that the Republican Party was a segregation party. No, sir. I believe that it was Republicans that were in the Underground Railroad, and that we need to remember this clearly, that when the rest of this nation was anti-freedom for slaves, that in essence it was Republicans that ran them into freedom at risk of death. But today you're going to tell me that that same Republican Party will not allow me and my friendships to be around them because we believe differently than them? Yes, sir, I do have a problem with that. That is not the Republican Party that I grew up in, and that's why I run as a Libertarian this year.
Stephen Peterson is candidate for U.S. Congress from North Dakota. Stephen, on your online podcast, you also, as you mentioned earlier, are for criminal justice reform, specifically as it deals with cannabis, and you cite some personal experience with that, and you, I'm quoting you here, you say in your podcast, once you've been to hell and back from it, certain things make you angry. Tell us about this position of yours and the fact that you were past cannabis caucus lobbyist in the Committee for Compassionate Care in front of the North Dakota legislature. So this is obviously something you feel strongly about.
I do. And, you know, I've been the enemy on that. And that's why it's so prescient to me. I was a professional bounty hunter, and I also know enough about criminal justice history to know that there was a time in history where my career field, my class of work, that we were the hunters of the runaway slaves. And I had to take great measure of my work when I was young to make sure that I did not betray that, because my mentor, the late Robert Young of the Bob Young Bail Bond Agency, who had been a stalwart anchor of North Dakota criminal justice for decades, had mentored me and trained me to make sure, regardless of any man's differences, that we guaranteed and protected their civil rights as much as possible. And to Bob, as long as you showed character and you showed that you had drive and that you wanted to do better for the world than yourself, he would give you a chance. And I learned from that. And I watched the courts not do this equally with our population here in North Dakota. I watched my friends who, because they were different, because they were black, because they were Latinos, because they were anything other than middle class, upper class, white, would be given 30, 60, 90, 1 year sentences. And then friends of mine from across the street in North High would be caught with the same amount of cannabis and given a deferred imposition and have their records plunged, sealed, and purged at the end of this, and while my other friends carry that mantle of conviction until the day they die. Yes, sir, there are great injustices that are tied to the cannabis front. It's not just about the medical side. It is very much tied to all the social justice issues. And I, sir, am not an entitlement seeker. No, rather, I believe that this is a human right. I believe that we need to remove those poor men and women who have been put into prisons in Louisiana for something that I now have sitting before me on my desk. Three joints put one man away for life. I have more than that sitting here on my desk to help me manage my back pain and anxiety at the moment. Is North Dakota going to put me away for three life sentences, sir? Yes, many of our ills here in the United States can be solved compassionately with the legalization of cannabis. And if we cannot at least come to terms with that here in 2020, in this 21st century time that we live in, then I say, sir, this country is doomed. Otherwise, please, please give me the chance to go to Washington to legalize this, because there are men, women, and others throughout the world that have been persecuted by our nation because of cannabis, and we need to come to terms with that.
Stephen James Peterson is the Libertarian candidate for the U.S. House from North Dakota. Stephen, I appreciate your candor.
I am very appreciative of your time today.
Coming up on Main Street, family-centered engagement meetings to help parents and children stay together and lessen the need for foster care. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. The Dakota gasification plant near Beulah is now shipping beverage-grade carbon dioxide liquid to water treatment plants in North Dakota. Dakota Gas Marketing Account Manager Zach Jacobson says the addition of the urea plant at Dakota Gas made CO2 liquid capture possible because that plant uses the liquid in its process. Jacobson says that grade of CO2 liquid has to be 99.98% pure, and he says Basin was contacted by a couple of customers who wanted to use it for beverages, welding, and water pH balancing. Jacobson says this summer, water treatment plants reported a shortage of CO2.
You know, there was almost a state of emergency in this in North Dakota because the usual sources where they got it from, such as ethanol plants, were curtailed on production because oil prices were not great, and B, the COVID-19 pandemic obviously had a great effect on that.
Jacobson says Basin heard from a number of state and local officials on the concerns about drinking water.
We got up and running, made our first sale June 30th, and supply over 80% of the needs of North Dakota water treatment plants.
Jacobson says Dakota Gas is still providing CO2 for enhanced oil recovery. He says there is a possibility down the road that the liquid CO2 may be sold to soft drink plants.
We tested for both Coke and Pepsi specs, which are some of the most stringent out there as far as liquid CO2, and we met and exceeded both of those limits. It's definitely a possibility. There's just a lot of challenges as far as, you know, timely deliveries, quantity concerns, those kind of things that we want to make sure we can fulfill before we kind of jump in with both feet.
Basin Electric Power Cooperative is the plant's owner. North Dakota State School Superintendent Kirsten Baszler says a new state partnership will help ease a shortage of special education teachers. The Department of Public Instruction and the Governor's Office are awarding a $750,000 grant to Minot State University. It'll pay for scholarships to 20 education paraprofessionals who work with special education students. Baszler says the scholarship aid is aimed at people who already have experience working with special education students.
These people have already worked in this field. They already know what the work entails, and they are choosing to further their education in order to become fully certified. And that's a win-win for their community. It's a win for their school districts, and most importantly, it's a win for the students they serve.
The paraprofessionals will use the money to earn bachelor's degrees with a special education major. The degree is needed to become a licensed special ed teacher.
They'll have the opportunity to go back to school to take these courses online and earn their Bachelor of Science degree and become fully certified special education teachers themselves.
The money was provided as part of the CARES Act that Congress approved last March. And for the first time in the event's 55-year history, Potato Bowl USA festivities have been canceled because of the coronavirus pandemic. In a statement, Potato Bowl Committee Chairman Todd Phelps said with COVID-19 still a threat and the suspension of the UND fall football season, this was inevitable. This year's events were scheduled to run from September 29th through October 3rd. The committee says it will begin plans for the 2021 Potato Bowl event. The first Potato Bowl was held in 1966. Annual events include the world's largest French fry feed, a parade, and a UND football game. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. Chuck Lura is a naturalist and retired biology professor who writes and voices Natural North Dakota. His essays look at the world around us, as in this follow-up to his observations about the milkweed and its unique way of making seeds.
You may recall the last week's Natural North Dakota topic was about milkweed's interesting pollination mechanisms. I'm still thinking about the common milkweed, but this time about fruit and seed production. If you're at all familiar with plants, you know that if all goes well, each flower should produce a fruit. An apple blossom should produce an apple. Each of those flowers in an inflorescence of a choke cherry plant should produce a choke cherry. And of course, the fruit should contain seeds to produce the next generation. The common milkweed is different. The common milkweed produces its flowers in dense clusters of somewhere between roughly 20 to over 100 individual flowers. What we call a milkweed pod is the fruit of the milkweed plant, but we don't see between 20 and 100 milkweed pods on a plant when autumn rolls around. There are often only 2 to 4 pods produced on a plant, each loaded with seeds. It could be that only a few of the flowers are actually pollinated, and as a result, only a few pods develop. Or perhaps most of the flowers are pollinated, and for some reason, only a few develop. It's not fully understood, but studies on milkweed production have found that most of the flowers are pollinated, but somehow the plant can assess how much energy it can expend in fruit and seed production and allocate the energy accordingly. An energy-stressed plant will produce fewer pods and seeds than one with abundant energy reserves. That might seem strange, but in milkweeds, apples, acorns, and many other species, fruit and seed production is thought to be related to how much of the plant's energy resources it can afford to use in reproduction. There are trade-offs between reproduction and other aspects of energy use. For example, the plant might be better off by putting some amount of energy into root growth instead of seeds. Somehow plants have the ability to adjust or change the allocations of energy from year to year. So if you see some milkweeds, make a point to observe them over the next couple of weeks just to see what happens with respect to pod and seed production. They may not have brains, but they're more responsive to physiological and environmental cues than we fully can explain. I'm Chuck Lehrer.
Natural North Dakota is supported in part by the NDSU Central Grasslands Research Extension Center. You can read and hear today's story at prairiepublic.org.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. The difficulties that result from broken families can reverberate for generations. Family-centered engagement meetings aim to help parents and children keep together and reduce the need for foster care. Main Street's Ashley Thornburg talked about the initiative with Tracy Miller, the Department of Human Services Child Maltreatment Prevention and Family Preservation Services Administrator, and Jesse Sorensen, who supervises the engagement program.
Tracy, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome. Thank you for having us.
Jesse, thank you for joining us today.
Yes, and thank you for having us.
What are some of the consequences of long-term foster care, particularly a child who might have to get bounced around from one house to the next?
The trauma of a child being removed from their home and put into placement increases, and each time you remove a child from a placement and into another, like you said, if they would get bounced around, it increases their trauma events. And so we would really like to decrease that. And by doing that, we just really want to try to divert children from ever entering foster care, but rather if they have to be removed from their home to be placed with a relative or kin. So, I mean, that's really our next step is what when we talk about placement, if mm-hmm. that child does need to be removed from the home, maybe for safety reasons or a mitigating threat that could be identified and taken care of within a week or two, can that child go and stay with grandma or aunt and uncle or even a close family friend like a kin? Can they go there for a couple of weeks? Can we make that so that the child doesn't actually enter into a foster care placement, into a stranger's home, or sure. into a facility?
This, as I understand, is a collaboration, or really it's combining the best elements of the family team decision-making effort and the family group decision-making effort, and now called the family-centered engagement. What were those previous attempts, and then now what is this hybrid version?
So in North Dakota, we've always had a long history of providing engagement and decision-making strategies. With family group decision-making, those services provided along more the continuum of a family. So maybe a child was out of home in a placement and maybe was going to blow out of that placement. You might have a family group decision-making meeting, which would bring all the elements and community members and supports together to look for trying to keep that child in that placement or look to maybe a relative or a new placement outside of foster care. The family team decision-making was really front end. So family team was having a meeting with families that first come into the child welfare system within 96 hours. So it was really a quick and fast meeting to have, and it was a decision making on placement of the child. It wasn't involving a lot of the family supports, maybe service providers. So what we did and worked with some consultants nationally is we kind of used principles from both of these models and built our own foundation of the family-centered engagement, which now kind of takes a lot of those principles from both of those models and we feel is more beneficial to families.
So is there a strict definition of the word family in the sense of family-centered engagement?
The family would be anybody that is involved in that child's life when they are touched into the child welfare system. So the families that use family-centered engagement have touched the child welfare system. And so when we say family, we would include any of those that have relationships to that child.
How long have you been running the family-centered engagement version?
Family-centered engagement began on a limited basis in selected North Dakota counties since the fall of 2018. Just this July 1st of 2020, we decided to move along statewide and have it to all human service center zones.
And what kinds of changes are you seeing?
Our data has been limited in the sense of because we haven't been statewide and we've only been in pockets of the state, so we don't have a lot of data. However, the data that we do have is showing some positive results in that at our six-month follow-ups, 77% of the children whose families engaged in FCE remained in the home with their parents rather than being removed or placed into foster care. Another 7% were placed with relatives and kin, which is another goal of family-centered engagement, is if we cannot prevent the removal of a child from their home, that we want to divert them and have them placed with relatives or kin.
How do the meetings actually work?
We have facilitators at the village, and county social services or juvenile court will send the referral in to us. They have a referral form. We look over that. We contact them if we have any questions on the referral form. The referral worker will list people they would like invited. And those, like Tracy had said, can be family, from parents, extended family. We invite the children when appropriate, family, friends, service providers, or any other community members and resources. So what we do as facilitators is we call the family and we set up a day and a time that works for them. Mm-hmm. And then so we have the people I just listed all around the table. We invite them, let them know where to go, what time it is. So we take care of all that prep work and then they show up and we have our meeting.
Mm. When you say invite the children in when appropriate, I'm sure that age is a factor. An 18-month-old, not really going to weigh in at a meeting. But what would be some of the other considerations that you need to take in mind?
We use the age around 12, and we take that from the KC Family Program. And we use that as well for family team and family group decision-making. Mm-hmm. Sometimes we may have a 10-year-old who is involved with juvenile court and it's appropriate for them to be at the meeting because, you know, all the concerns are, you know, around them. Sometimes we have somebody that may not be developmentally ready at age 13, 14, so we won't have them at the meeting, or we'll have them in certain parts at the meeting. Maybe we want them there just to talk about concerns and then talk about some strengths and supports as well. And then we could have them leave the meeting while we come up with a plan, or each case is different. We take it as a case-by-case basis.
Who is ultimately eligible to participate in the FCE meetings?
So currently there are three populations of children that are eligible for a family-centered engagement meeting. It would be any child at risk of removal, any child who is experiencing an emergency removal and so has been taken under the temporary custody of the human service zone and has 96 hours before the shelter care hearing. And then the third are dual status youth who are not in care, so they cannot be in foster care, but are at risk of removal and are currently involved in both the child welfare and juvenile justice systems. So when we talk about referrals to a family-centered engagement meeting, the village only accepts referrals from the child welfare system and juvenile justice system.
Are there opportunities to talk about additional services? For example, there might be a case of child needs to leave for maybe 6 weeks or, you know, 6 months, but then ultimately gets placed back into the home of the biological family because of other services, you know, rehab or getting a job or whatever the other mitigating factors might be.
So the goal of the FCE is hopefully come up with a plan that we can help the child succeed within their home or within family. Of course, there are times where the child is, you know, removed from the home and placed elsewhere. And the goal is always reunification, you know, with the family. And we do 6 month follow-ups. So we are able to see where the kids are within that 6 months and what services they had participated in within that 6 months. But yeah, the goal is always to have the child with their parents or family.
So what I would add is, what we want to try to get away from are those short stayers in foster care. Mm-hmm. So to your question about 6 weeks, do they need to just be out of the home for 6 weeks? And so what we're trying to do with some of this and that follow-up at 6 months is, if the child has to be removed and it is in a short period of time, did we really ever really have to remove that child? Mm. So that's really what we're looking at with some of this 6 month follow-up, that are we reducing the number of children that are being removed for 4 weeks and then back in the home? Is there something we could have offered or a service that could have been provided in those 4 weeks and keeping the child in the home and improving the status within rather than removing the child? So that is something that we are looking at. And again, hopefully now that we are statewide, we'll have some comparison data and some numbers, you know, eventually. But those are exactly the cases that we're really trying to divert from going into foster care.
Okay. I imagine the algorithm is a tricky one to come up with, because I'm thinking too about just the geographical concern. There might be an aunt, and it would be a wonderful fit to have this child go to an aunt, but all of a sudden, you know, she's 90 minutes away and it's a totally different school system, and then that just creates a different kind of interruption in a child's life. So I'm sure there's no clear answer of how you work through this algorithm, but if you're able to sort of go through that decision-making process of how you look at all of the different circumstances to try to make the best choice for the child.
Correct. And the family-centered engagement meeting should help with that. So if we have people around the table, so for instance, we might have a situation where there's some chaos in a family, and it's mainly from the after-school time until the parent can get home. They don't have child care. So basically, we have kids coming home that shouldn't be left alone, and maybe something had happened. So having a family-centered engagement meeting is pulling those supports. So is there a neighbor? Is there a grandma? Is there somebody who would agree to come in and be there from 3 to 5 until mom or dad or whoever the parent is can get home and take on those parenting duties? Sometimes it's really just getting the people around the table and really processing through and talking through what is really needed and who can offer that support. So, I mean, the whole premise of family-centered engagement is really having everybody around and what support can we offer that family to keep that child in the home.
Mm-hmm. I understand that these meetings are happening via the internet right now as often as possible because of the pandemic. What other changes have you had to do to the program since mid-March?
The changes that we've had to make would be how we do the FCE meetings. We now do them, you know, over the computer through Zoom, and it works very well. Families are able to dial in on their phone or their computer, and we can all connect by video. We've found actually with doing it this way, we have more family able to show up because they're able to show up wherever they are, easier for them. Don't have to worry about transportation at times. Due to the circumstances, it has actually worked out very well. I would say that would be the biggest change. And then we went statewide July 1st.
How do you tackle matters of confidentiality when you're having these meetings over Zoom, particularly when you have to involve maybe the juvenile justice system, or there might be some health concerns, could be some HIPAA regulations here, and it's not impossible to hack a Zoom meeting?
So the telehealth that they use through the village has security pieces and actually is held up to all the HIPAA compliance. There's different levels of Zoom which you can access or buy. Okay. And the village has the highest level, which actually covers any of the HIPAA compliance and telehealth concerns and confidentiality.
There is confidentiality within our meetings. We talk about that with the parents as well, or the guardian caregivers prior. We go through a confidentiality piece.
You have now in shortly anyway, you'll have the data 6 months out from the statewide launch. We have a few months to go on that, of course. But what will be your plan once you get that data in terms of the next step? Or can you not know what your next step will be until you look at how the state is doing compared to just the few counties that launched the program?
Correct. I think we really need to look at the data to see how are we affecting change within across the state within the human service zones. And again, I would say we will for sure look at our short stayer data, how many kids are coming in and out of foster care less than 90 days. So that is something I know that we are very interested in. Another thing is utilization is, are the human service zones making referrals timely and when appropriate for a family-centered engagement meeting? Mm-hmm. And are we utilizing this meeting appropriately? So some of that quality assurance pieces will also be looked at. So it's pretty exciting. I think we feel that with the data that we do have, which is limited, we are seeing some positive results. And our goal is to continue to, if we need to make changes or modifications, we will do that because we want to just support keeping kids in their home and making sure that we're offering a service that does that.
At the beginning of the conversation, it was mentioned that this grew out of a meeting with consultants. The FCE came out of combining the family team decision making and the family group decision making. To me, that there were consultants means that it's possible that this, or at least a similar program, has been launched in another state. Are you able to look at what's happened in other states already using a similar program?
There's not a lot of states, but there are states out there that do family team decision making or family group decision making. But we did not come across anybody who morphed their own and did their own hybrid like we did. One of our consultants was from Washington State, and she was the supervisor of the family team decision making for Washington State. Okay. So she just allowed us and helped us think through some things. We had consultants from the Capacity Building Center for States. And then we had a consultant from the Kemp Center helping us identify maybe what our quality assurance and goals are. So we did have lots of thoughts, but per se in a family-centered engagement, because it's a hybrid, we don't have another state to look at per se like that.
So other states might be looking to North Dakota in the future.
Maybe if we can show some good outcomes, which I'm hoping we can do, and again, and really honing down on those short stayers and keeping them out of foster care, I think it is something that we will be able to present to other states saying this has worked.
Tracy, thank you for joining us today.
You're welcome. Thank you for having us.
Jesse, thank you for your time today.
Thank you.
Ashley Thornburg with Tracy Miller and Jesse Sorensen with the North Dakota Department of Human Services. Dakota Datebook is next.
When you hear arts programming on Prairie Public, know that it's supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Bush Foundation, investing in great ideas and the people who power them. In Minnesota, North Dakota, South Dakota, and the 23 Native nations that share that same geography. Learn more at bushfoundation.org.
Look at the right way to visit Fiji.
Fiji's waters are really rich in marine life, and they are protected.
The wisdom of the world's great thinkers.
How can I lead a better, more meaningful life? That is the essence of philosophy, I think.
And what to expect in a pandemic.
So I've been grateful to this moment for opening my eyes to what is really always around us.
It's on the next Travel with Rick Steves.
Tonight at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for August 12th. President Theodore Roosevelt's time in what is now North Dakota is known for the hunting and ranching that helped soothe his soul and form his outlook on conservation. There are many famous episodes, his persistent pursuit of his first bison, chasing boat thieves down the Little Missouri River, and giving his 4th of July speech in Dickinson. Also, during his time out west, two births at his Elkhorn Ranch. Two woodsmen from Maine, Bill Sewell and his nephew, Wilmot Dow, built and managed the ranch. It's about 35 miles north of Medora along the river. In 1885, they were joined by Dow's wife, Lizzie, and Sewell's wife, Mary, and their daughter, Lucretia. Roosevelt adored the Sewells' little girl and called her Kitty. He asked his sister Anna to send toys for her from New York. Mary Sewell and Lizzie Dow did cooking, cleaning, housekeeping, and gardening. Roosevelt supplied them with chickens, which attracted bobcats. Mary baked bread and cake and made jam from wild plums and buffalo berries. Roosevelt's new ranch house was made a home. On this date, in 1886, Lizzie Dow gave birth to a boy, also named Wilmot. He was born 1 week after Mary Sewell gave birth to a son named Fred. "We were 110 miles from the nearest physician," Bill Sewell later wrote. "The only help we could get was the wife of an old hunter who lived several miles from us. My wife was terribly sick. The only reason they did not both die was because their time had not come. But both the women lived and are still alive, and the boys lived to make strong men." Roosevelt, upon returning to his ranch soon after the births, found Sewell building a cradle for the babies. "The population of my ranch is increasing in a rather alarming manner," Roosevelt wrote to his sister, Anna. Cowboys from near and far came to see the Badlands babies. But the romantic home life didn't last long. Roosevelt returned to the Elkhorn from a mountain goat hunt in the Coeur d'Alene Mountains in September and came to an agreement with Sewell and Dow to end their contract. Sewell had always figured the Badlands wouldn't promise well. A drought gripped the area that summer, and though they couldn't know it, a devastating winter would soon cripple cattle operations. The short-lived golden days of the Elkhorn Ranch were all but over. Today's Dakota Datebook, written by Jack Dura. I'm Bill Thomas.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Today's programming is made possible in part by Dr. Don and Sharon Kane in celebration of their 60th wedding anniversary.
Thursday on our show, summer is the season of road trips, and few road trips could be as memorable as getting behind the wheel of a 27-foot hot dog to drive across the country. Yes, it's the Wienermobile. Ashley Thornburg caught up with it to talk with hot doggers Zach and Cheese and Mustard Mags. Then we'll have Main Street Eats with Sue Balcom. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Thursday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.